Intimate partner violence is more prevalent for women in the U.S. than breast cancer and diabetes combined. We're talking about the role of healthcare providers in identifying and preventing such violence.
We also know that, many people who are being hurt by their partners are prevented from seeing providers on a regular basis. Sometimes that changes during pregnancy. They're actually allowed to go seek care for their pregnancy and, for the baby.
Our guest is Virginia Duplessis. She is the Associate Director at Futures Without Violence and the Director of the National Health Resource Center on Domestic Violence.
Unfortunately, I don't think that we are going to be put out of business anytime soon in terms of thinking about an end to violence. And we're really leaning into, what are new areas that we can think about that contribute to violence happening and violence being tolerated.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, welcome, Virginia, to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We always like to start with an overview, and I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners how Futures Without Violence works towards its goal, and maybe explain the role of the National Health Resource Center on Domestic Violence as well.
Sure. So Futures Without Violence is a nonprofit. We have our headquarters here in San Francisco, where I'm joining you from. We also have offices in Boston and in Washington, D.C. And really, our name says it all. We're trying to work to create that future without violence. I'm on the health team, so we work specifically with the healthcare sector, but we have teams that work with judges, with coaches, really just trying to impact all sectors so they can do a better job of preventing and responding to violence through policy work, through training and education. I think that we have realized that violence is not an inevitable part of the human experience, and we all have a unique and important role. So in terms of the National Health Resource Center, our work, when I'm at a cocktail party and someone asks me, what do I do day in and day out? And I say that my job is to help healthcare providers and healthcare systems be able to talk about prevention so that violence doesn't happen in the first place, and also to support people who have experienced violence. We also work very closely with domestic violence programs, so people who are seeing survivors of violence, to help them connect their clients with healthcare.
Well, your work is near and dear to our heart because as part of our primary care system, we have both healthcare and we also have had for more than 40 years a 24/7 domestic violence shelter, an emergency shelter, and then the full continuum of services. So we have so much to learn from you today and to share with our listeners. Really want to thank you for being here. We are always struck by the research that shows that survivors are four times more likely to use an intervention like a domestic violence service after talking with a healthcare provider about what they're experiencing in terms of abuse. But you've noted that you still see reluctance among healthcare providers in bringing up the topic, even though screening for intimate partner violence has been considered a routine, if you will, expectation in primary care for many years now. How do you overcome this reluctance?
I think really the big message to healthcare providers and health systems is that no one should be doing this alone, right? So we don't expect healthcare providers to be experts in how to help, the nitty-gritty of helping someone who's experienced violence. It's really important to partner with those local programs in your community. So if you are having conversations with patients about relationship safety and relationship quality, in your back pocket, if someone does say, yeah, things are tricky in my relationship, I might want to talk to someone or, I need some help, to already have established a connection to that domestic violence program, to legal services. So I think that's really, once healthcare providers understand, aha, I don't have to do all of this by myself, it helps. The other thing to just remember is, it's not as if healthcare providers don't also have their own experiences of violence, whether it's currently, in their past, in their family of origin. And so we really spend a lot of time also talking about how healthcare providers can take care of themselves and not have that experience of, you know, vicarious trauma because they're talking to patients about this. So we try to, from the beginning, set providers up for success, both connecting them with resources for patients and clients, and also doing that hard, you know, emotional work of really grappling with, you know, if you have this in your history as well, it can be harder.
Mm-hmm. Margaret, one of the things I find fascinating about this group is that their training tools are online. They're very effective. Maybe tell us how you help providers spot violence when the victim may want to cover it up. And so many different examples we could give, but the woman who claims she fell off the ladder and was injured when really her husband beat her.
Okay, so this is actually one of the most exciting parts of our work, I think. Trying to catch someone before they're pushed down the stairs and really having conversations about healthy and safe relationships before things are escalating to that level of violence. So we're really encouraging healthcare providers to start with talking about what it looks like to be treated with kindness and respect. And if things feel a little bit crunchy, not quite right, how you can get help at that stage. And then having, not waiting for a red flag, but really talking with all patients about this and being clear about that. Because if you're a survivor, you don't want to, that's only one part of your identity, one part of your experience walking through the world. No one wants to think that they have like domestic violence, right? Plastered across their forehead. It's really important to tell every patient, we know that this is so common. Lots of people experience domestic violence. It has a really big impact on your health. So I think it's important to talk to everyone about this and then provide that information in a non-judgmental way. We know that success doesn't necessarily mean someone telling us what's happening at home. We really measure our success by, does the patient leave feeling supported, listened to, and have access to information about what's available in the community if they choose to seek help? And that's a big difference, right? Doctors, nurses, providers want to identify a problem, give someone a solution, and see that that is followed through. And we know with an issue like this, it's not always that simple.
Well, I think the research is very sobering because it makes it clear what I think everybody already knows. This is a life and death issue. We try for prevention wherever we can, but particularly in the area of pregnant women and those who've recently given birth, those in the postpartum period. And this always just astonishes me that those women are more likely to be murdered in the U.S. than die from obstetrical causes such as hypertensive disorders or sepsis or hemorrhage, which we hear so much about. And of course, the combination of gun violence and domestic violence is lethal. What do you think that hospitals, OBGYNs, nurse midwives can do to try and change this?
So I think there are solutions at every level. First of all, when we think about it from a systems level, research, what kind of data gets collected, we need to be more intentional about acknowledging the role that intimate partner violence, domestic violence has in maternal and infant mortality. As you mentioned, there's a, you know, the attention is really on those obstetric causes, but, and IPV is also a huge driver of poor outcomes for pregnant people and their babies. And then on that more of an individual level, I really think it is creating those opportunities for providers to talk openly about relationship quality and safety. The beautiful thing about pregnancy and postpartum is providers just have more touch points with patients. We know that sometimes what it takes for someone to feel comfortable bringing this up, accepting referrals, is that time together, is building that trust. So this is a really unique opportunity to have that impact. We also know that, many people who are being hurt by their partners are prevented from seeing providers on a regular basis. Sometimes that changes during pregnancy. They're actually allowed to go seek care for their pregnancy and, you know, for the baby. And so it could be that this is a person who has really been isolated and not had a chance to talk with a doctor or nurse. And so we want to make sure that we are taking advantage of that one-on-one support that they're getting.
You know, thinking about providers building trust, certainly that's sort of the foundational foundation of the community health center movement. And I know you're engaged working with community health centers. Maybe talk a little bit about what the National Training and Support Project is doing in helping them out as well. And just as a reminder, I think most of our audience knows that 1,600 health centers across the country, 10,000 locations, 31 plus million individuals served.
Yeah, so we also have a resource center that is specific to community health centers. And again, building that motivation and prioritizing talking about violence in that clinical setting and those really close partnerships with the community organizations that serve survivors. So we do training and technical assistance. We have national events. We have lots of resources that are available online. And one thing that's really unique is we have a series of communities of practice. So we have community health centers that come online and meet for, you know, four sessions over a number of weeks. They also bring their domestic violence organization partners to really work through, you know, what does it take for us to strengthen our partnerships? What are the different strategies that we can adapt in our communities really to do a better job of addressing this issue that we know, unfortunately, impacts so many people in our communities? And for health sites that are serving underserved communities, you know, we see prevalence rates that are higher because these are folks who don't necessarily have access to lots of other supports and resources. So I want to make sure that we are reaching those who are typically underserved.
And you described the structure of how people come together. Any best practices that you've identified and are sharing with other health centers in terms of examples of that intervention?
Sure, definitely. So a couple of things, some of them are topical. So, you know, how do we specifically reach survivors who may be experiencing homelessness? What are the strategies that we've created in community for survivors who are struggling with substance use? And so it's really a lot of bi-directional learning. Here at Futures, you know, we have many, many years of this national overview of what's happening in communities, participating in research to identify those best practices, and we know we can learn from community. So I think part of our cornerstone really is, as I talked about earlier, developing those partnerships between health settings and social service settings, and then doing this universal education on healthy relationships and providing information about where to get help if someone is experiencing violence. And that can be applied in a lot of different ways.
Well, one place I'd love for you to expand upon is the school setting and adolescents, right? A particularly vulnerable group, hopefully more becoming more self-aware, able to both advocate for themselves and protect themselves. But you say that providers need to be prepared to talk to people of all ages. So tell us, particularly in relationship to teens, they're transitioning sometimes with their pediatrician. Sometimes they've moved on to more of an adult provider. They may be in a school-based health center or Planned Parenthood or another organization. What are you recommending for those providers in terms of training and activity?
I'm so glad you asked about adolescents. Part of my career actually was in adolescent health, working for a county public health department that did health education for teens. And then I did some work also in a high school, school-based health center. So this is a topic Perfect. That is near and dear to me. And as you mentioned, it's a time of incredible development and growth for young people. They are practicing relationships, figuring out what does it mean to be romantically involved with someone, or maybe it's not romantic, maybe you're just having sex, that's okay too. And so we have this period of time that we can have a lot of influence on those beliefs and behaviors moving forward. So a lot of times we actually approach it more as, what would you do if a friend were in this situation, right? Because we know there can be some reticence to that kind of direct inquiry about what's happening in your life. It's more about being a good friend. Bystander intervention, I think, is also another strategy that's really powerful in this age group, because people want to feel that they're making a difference in their community, right? And we do see, unfortunately, you know, rates of teen dating violence are high. We know that for fatal domestic violence, that age group, 15 to 24 is the highest age group where we see intimate partner homicide. So I think it's really incumbent on us in those health settings to make sure that we're talking about this at every visit, you know, and having the message in lots of different ways, having your provider talk with you, having posters in your clinic, having those safety cards in your bathroom. So really saturating those settings to make sure that young people know this is an important topic that is going to be covered, you know, in our health settings. And the opportunities to do some of the conversations confidentially. You know, young people are just starting out negotiating how to communicate with healthcare providers. And so this is an area that we can kind of build that health literacy muscle, right? And help young people negotiate those conversations on their own.
Well, you said something dear to our hearts, school-based health centers. We operate 160 of them across the state and also are engaged with the School-Based Health Alliance. But talk a little bit about what you're doing. That's sort of a separate setting. Sometimes health centers have school-based, but sometimes, many times, they're independent. Are there any special interventions that you're doing with them? And I think you raised the point earlier, getting them at a young age. Mm-hmm. And setting them out in the right direction is so important. So that seems to be an early intervention.
Early intervention in the health center. And we, again, like to have kind of a saturated environment. So what else is happening in the school that really supports young people entering into healthy and safe relationships, speaking up if they see something that's not quite right? So another arm of Futures actually has a program called Coaching Boys into Men, which helps young people also navigate and talk about respectful relationships in that athletic setting. I mean, we've seen successes where, you know, if we have multiple programs happening in at one school site, just the impacts are even more powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think that all of the interventions that we've seen, all of the strategies really hinge on harnessing the enthusiasm and energy of young people as they are developing into adults, right? And creating, identifying their own values. Like if we can have a conversation about what kind of person do you want to be in this world? What kind of friend? What kind of partner? That is really powerful. And I think in the adolescent health setting especially, most providers are oriented toward that, right? They're really excited to do this kind of anticipatory guidance, and they're not strangers to it. So we are really just providing additional tools and supports, ideas for how to have these conversations. But most of the time, those providers are, you know, they've got the skills. They just need a couple more tools in their toolbox in order to feel successful and effective.
That's right. That's so important. And if we learn anything in community health, that is that it takes a village and there's a continuum. It's never too late for prevention. It may be secondary. It may be after an initial event has happened. But I wonder, and don't know if this is within your scope within futures, but certainly a critical partner is law enforcement and the folks who respond to those 911 calls and make the assessments, determine the level of risk, and make the decision about arrests, not arrests, and then into the court system. And I think we've seen progress in funding along that whole continuum from primary prevention down to let us make sure that we get through this situation without loss of life and don't have recurrence. Tell me what you're doing with law enforcement around that kind of training and education about their role, prevention if we can, secondary prevention if it has to be, but at all costs trying to protect life.
Yeah, so a couple things I'll mention. For all of our work in partnerships, we see the importance of bringing in many community partners, right? So when we have coordinated community response teams, we encourage, you know, who in law enforcement can you bring to the table? It is important to remember that the majority of survivors do not engage with law enforcement, which is why, again, it's so important to make sure that other helpers like healthcare providers are also doing this prevention and response work. We have a long history, especially working with judges, right? So that's a little bit further in the criminal legal system, but I think it does also send a really big message to make sure that we have law enforcement that is trauma-informed, right? That really understands some of the dynamics that go into intimate partner violence and why is it that someone might be reluctant to call the police or to say they want to press charges? And kind of by increasing that understanding, we see the frustration lower a lot, because that is some of the feedback we've gotten is, you know, police officers are like, I show up at this house many times. They never want to press charges. Why do I even come anymore? And just to help them understand how that is part of that trauma response, the empathy really increases, I think, which helps overall.
That's great.
Yeah. And we see the importance in our own work that we do, having people in the courts. We have two full-time people who are in the courts, working with the district attorney, working with the judges, and obviously working with the police. And so on their home territory, which is very important in a place where women come in quite often. You know, I want to shift topics a little and talk a little bit about human trafficking, which affects nearly 28 million people worldwide, has similar devastating health impacts as intimate partner violence. What more can the healthcare sector do about human trafficking? And is that an area that you are focused in on?
Yes. Yeah, so especially our community health center project does have particular resources and learning communities that are focused on trafficking and exploitation. We know that there's so much overlap of all these issues, sexual assault, domestic violence, trafficking, exploitation, and helping providers, helping systems normalize conversations. I think especially for trafficking, it can feel overwhelming and scary to say, I'm going to address this. And just remembering, okay, what can we do from that prevention and early intervention standpoint? And then, of course, if things have escalated, you know, where can we send someone for help? What are the resources that we can call in to help a victim or survivor? And again, when we think about young people and adolescent health, that's also a really vulnerable time for young people, especially those from marginalized communities, you know, being more at risk for being trafficked or exploited. And so, you know, we don't want to scare people off, but we also want to be realistic about this experience that is pretty prevalent.
Well, we're always interested in learning from you, from others, and what people are doing in other parts of the country. So we've heard about the ACEs Aware Family Resilience Network in California. Very intriguing. Why don't you share that with us and our listeners?
Sure. So here in California, we have really been investing in how do we reduce the number of adverse childhood experiences of Californians. And so the state has really made an investment in grants to community groups, and we're providing training and technical assistance to really test what works in communities. Not just, I think for some time we were kind of laser focused on those ACEs screenings and what is your number? How many ACEs have you experienced in your life? And that is not a number we can change. So, okay, we've identified, but really what can we do to help promote healing and thriving, right? If we do have folks who've experienced ACEs, and what can we do for prevention? And part of what I think is so beautiful about the ACEs program is identifying things that help that don't require a lot of additional resources or going to appointments. It's like, how do you build strengths within yourself to help emotionally regulate, to reach out for support in your community, identifying those cultural values and traditions that bring you strength and happiness, and really leaning into that. So I love that project. I think it's so important, even as we talk about all of the negative impacts and devastation that all of these different forms of violence bring, really bringing it back to, we have strength, personal strengths, community strengths that can help us heal and thrive.
That's great.
And that's what we're leaning into.
Oh, that's great. Virginia, I'd like to talk about Future's future. So maybe you could tell us what the state of your financial model is right now. Has it been impacted by what's happening in Washington? And then maybe just sort of programmatically, what are you thinking about as you look out on the horizon?
Yeah, so, you know, unfortunately, I don't think that we are going to be put out of business anytime soon in terms of thinking about an end to violence. And we're really leaning into, what are new areas that we can think about that contribute to violence happening and violence being tolerated. So how are ways that we can change social norms, right? And so some of our work is around the experience of manhood and boyhood and how we can really bring a healthier masculinity. Taking a look at things like economic security, right? Because we know that is also a driver of victimization and also perpetration, actually. So, you know, what can we do to increase the economic prosperity of all people as one way to address some of these drivers of violence? In terms of our financial outlook, I think we're always open to and looking for new and different partnerships. We have a great mix of funding. Certainly, government funding is a part of our portfolio, which we need to always be mindful of. But, you know, I think that there are so many people out in our community who are committed to making sure that Futures remains solvent and successful. So I have a positive outlook there.
How long have you been now in existence?
40 years.
Wow, congratulations.
Perfect. That's congratulations. Yeah. About as long as our domestic violence program within our organization. Virginia, we want to thank you. We want to thank Futures Without Violence for the very important work that you do, both in intervention, but also in prevention and education. Thank you to our audience for being here. And please remember to subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X, and also please share your thoughts and your comments about this program. Take care and be well. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.